The pavement in New York does not feel like the earth back home. It is hard. It is unforgiving. It does not breathe. For the thousands of Caribbean people stepping off planes at Idlewild Airport in the 1950s, the first thing they felt was the cold. It was not just the weather. It was the coldness of a city that needed their labor, but did not want their presence. Our people arrived with cardboard suitcases and iron shirts. They brought recipes memorized by heart and a drive that the local authorities did not anticipate. We were moving from the front porch to the basement. We were trading the open horizon for the cramped tenement. But within those walls, something was shifting. New York was about to be remade. This is not a story of finding the American dream. It is a story of building a new one from scratch. Chapter 1. The First Flight. The wind across the tarmac at Idlewild Airport in 1952 did not carry the scent of salt or roasting coffee. It carried the smell of jet fuel and burnt rubber. For a young man from Kingston or a family from Santo Domingo, the descent into New York was a visual shock. The green hills of the islands were replaced by a gray interlocking grid of stone and steel. This was the beginning of a great migration that would redefine the North. The United States had passed the McCarran-Walter Act in 1952. It was a restrictive piece of legislation designed to keep the demographics of the country static. It favored Northern Europeans. It looked at the Caribbean with a suspicious eye. Yet the city was hungry. The post-war boom created a vacuum in the service industry, in the hospitals, and in the garment factories. Our people filled those gaps. They came because the colonial economies back home were fracturing. The promise of the islands was moving slow. The promise of the city was moving fast. When you arrived in Harlem or Bedford-Stuyvesant in the early 50s, you were entering a world of shadows. The Caribbean sun was gone. You lived in a tenement. These were narrow buildings designed to pack as many bodies as possible into a single square block. The air was heavy with the smell of coal dust and old wood. For many, the first winter was a trauma. You learned quickly that a coat from home was not a coat for New York. You learned how to bleed the radiators to get a hiss of steam. You learned the names of the streets by the sounds of the subway, rattling the windows. The community did not wait for permission to exist. They carved it out of the basements. In Harlem, West Indians and Latinos began to cluster. They were often grouped together by locals, who could not hear the difference between a Jamaican accent and a Barbadian one. But the migrants knew. They sought out their own. They formed benevolent societies. These were informal banks. If a man died, the society paid for the funeral. If a woman wanted to bring her daughter up from Port-au-Prince, the society pooled the money for the ticket. This was the SUSU, or the partner system. It was an underground economy of trust. It functioned because it had to. The formal banks saw a black or brown face and closed the ledger. The early 50s were a time of quiet observation. You kept your head down. You worked the double shift at the hospital. You sent the money back. The remittance became the lifeblood of the islands. For every dollar earned in a Brooklyn kitchen, a roof was repaired in St. Kitts. But the city was changing the people too. You could no longer spend the evening sitting on a veranda, talking to neighbors. The neighbors were now behind locked doors. The social life moved to the church halls and the basement parties. These were illegal and loud. They were the only places where the music sounded right. In a basement in Crown Heights, you could forget the gray sky. You could pretend the walls were not closing in. By 1958, the numbers were swelling. The Caribbean presence was no longer a trickle. It was a tide. The local political machines began to take notice. They saw a new block of people who were literate, motivated, and increasingly frustrated. The tension was not just with the white power structure. There was tension with the African-American community as well. These were two groups of the same tree, separated by different histories of survival. The New Yorkers saw the newcomers as too stiff, too British, or too foreign. The newcomers saw the locals as too resigned. It was a friction that produced heat, and eventually, it would produce fire. The struggle was not just about money. It was about the soul. How do you keep the Caribbean alive in a place where you cannot grow a mango tree? You do it through the senses. The first Caribbean grocery stores began to appear. They were small, cramped holes in the wall. They sold salted cod and hard dough bread. they sold plantains that were often bruised from the long journey. But when you stepped inside, the smell was a bridge. It was a way to survive the workday. You worked for the city, but you lived for the weekend. You lived for the moments when the language of home could be spoken without translation. As the decade turned, the pressure increased. The world was changing. The islands were talking about independence. The civil rights movement in the United States was beginning to roar. The Caribbean migrant was caught in the middle of two revolutions. They were citizens of nowhere and everywhere. They were building a middle class in the heart of the ghetto. They were buying brownstones that no one else wanted. They were fixing the plumbing. They were scrubbing the steps. They were staking a claim to the dirt. But the laws of the land were still designed to keep them as temporary guests. The question was no longer if they would stay. The question was what they would have to break to be seen. The first generation was tired. They had worked the hardest years of their lives to buy a piece of the city. They thought they had reached the end of the struggle. They thought the children would have it easier. They did not know that the next wave of migration would bring a different kind of energy. They did not know that the city itself was about to go broke. The foundation was laid, but the walls were still thin. The wind was picking up again. The planes kept landing. The cold kept biting. And in the dark hallways of Brooklyn, a new generation was looking out the window, wondering why they were here. The city was a promise that had not yet been kept. Chapter 2: The Concrete Jungle. 1965 changed the map of New York forever. The Immigration and Nationality Act was signed. It ended the old quota system. It opened the doors to the world. For the Caribbean, this was the explosion. The trickle of the 50s became a flood in the 60s and 70s. This was the era of the professional migration. Nurses from Jamaica, accountants from Trinidad, and teachers from Guyana filled the neighborhoods of Queens and the Bronx. They were not just laborers anymore. They were the infrastructure of the city. But they were entering a New York that was falling apart. The 1970s in New York were a decade of smoke. The city was facing a fiscal crisis. Services were cut. The benign neglect policy meant that poor neighborhoods were left to burn. Literally. In the South Bronx and Central Brooklyn, the Caribbean community found itself on the front lines of an urban war. They had invested their life savings into homes that were now surrounded by abandoned buildings. This was the test of the diaspora. You do not run when the fire starts. You stand your ground. The bodega and the patty shop became the new cathedrals. These were more than businesses. They were intelligence hubs. In a Dominican bodega in Washington Heights, you could find out who was hiring, who was moving, and who had died back home. The shopkeeper was a banker, a translator, and a judge. This was where the barrel economy was managed. Every month, massive blue plastic barrels were packed with clothes, soap, and canned goods. They were shipped back to the islands. It was a circular flow of survival. The city provided the wages. The islands provided the identity. This period saw the rise of the transnational family. Mothers would leave their children in the care of grandmothers in the islands for years while they worked as nannies or nurses in New York. The barrel children grew up knowing their parents through the items sent in the mail. It was a sacrifice of the heart for the sake of the future. When those children finally arrived in New York, the reunion was often cold. They were strangers in a house bought by their own absence. This tension between the home they remembered and the city they occupied created a new kind of Caribbean identity. It was harder. It was more cynical. The streets were meaner now. The Caribbean youth of the 70s and 80s were not like their parents. They did not have the British or French or Spanish colonial manners that the first generation used as a shield. They were New Yorkers. They were being influenced by the birth of hip-hop and the rising tide of reggae and salsa. The music was becoming a weapon. It was a way to claim the sidewalk. When a sound system set up in a park in East Flatbush, it was a declaration of sovereignty. The bass was so loud it rattled the police cruisers. It said, "We are here. We are not leaving." But the pressure was internal too. The 1980s brought the crack cocaine epidemic. It tore through the fabric of the community. It turned neighbors against each other. The media began to paint a picture of the Caribbean Yardie or the Dominican drug lord. This was a dangerous myth that ignored the millions of hard-working families, but it had a real impact on how the community was policed. The surveillance increased. the trust eroded. Our people had to fight the city for resources and fight the streets for their children. Survival meant adaptation. The Caribbean community began to take over the small economies that the city ignored. They took over the dollar van routes when the buses failed to run in the outer boroughs. They took over the laundromats. They took over the nursing homes. They were the invisible New Yorkers. They were the ones who cleaned the offices at 4 a.m. and cooked the food in the back of the five-star restaurants. They were the engine of the city, but they were still being denied a seat at the table. The politics of the diaspora began to shift. You could no longer just care about what happened in Kingston or Santo Domingo. You had to care about the school board in District 17. You had to care about the precinct commander. The realization began to dawn. The islands were the past. New York was the future. This was a painful transition. It meant admitting that you might never go back to stay. It meant admitting that your children's children would speak with a Brooklyn accent. By the end of the 80s, the Caribbean footprint was massive. Entire zip codes were now functionally part of the West Indies or the Spanish Caribbean. You could walk for 40 blocks in Brooklyn and never hear a standard American accent. The smell of jerk chicken and sofrito defined the air. The community had survived the fires, the fiscal collapse, and the epidemic. They had built a city within a city, but a new threat was coming. It wasn't fire this time, it was money. The very neighborhoods they had saved from the brink were starting to look attractive to people who had never stepped foot in them. The reinvention was working too well. The price of the dirt was going up, and the people who had held the ground were about to be told they didn't belong on it. Chapter 3. The New Empire. The 1990s were the decade of the arrival. Not of people, but of power. The Caribbean community in New York stopped being a migrant group and started being a political force. The first Caribbean-born officials began to win seats in the city council. They were no longer begging for resources, they were allocating them. This was the era of the West Indian Day Parade on Eastern Parkway, becoming the most important political event in the state. If you wanted to be mayor, if you wanted to be governor, you had to walk that route. You had to eat the food. You had to wave the flag. This was the visible peak of the diaspora. But beneath the celebration, the stakes were changing. The census of 2000 showed that the Caribbean population had reached a critical mass. In some parts of Brooklyn and Queens, more than half the residents were foreign-born. This gave the community leverage in Washington. It meant federal funding. It meant recognition. But it also drew a target on the neighborhoods. Gentrification began to creep in like a slow tide. It started in Fort Greene. It moved to Bedford-Stuyvesant. It pushed into Crown Heights and Flatbush. The brownstones that the grandfathers had fixed with their own hands in the 60s were now worth millions of dollars. The irony was bitter. The Caribbean community had stayed when the city was burning. They had patrolled their own streets. They had built the churches and the businesses. Now that the city was safe and prosperous, they were being priced out of their own creations. The Little Haiti and Little Caribbean designations were a response to this. They were attempts to plant a flag in the concrete. They were symbols of resistance against the erasure of the culture. When a developer knocks down a bakery that has been there for 40 years to build a glass tower, it is not just a building that is lost. It is a piece of the collective memory. It is a link to the island that gets severed. The second and third generations are now the leaders. They are doctors, lawyers, and tech founders. They are New Yorkers to the bone, but they carry the hyphenated identity with a new kind of pride. They are not trying to hide their roots to fit in. They are using their roots to stand out. They are the ones bridge building between the old world and the new. They are the ones who realize that home is no longer a geographical location. Home is the network. It is the WhatsApp group that spans three continents. It is the flight from JFK to San Juan that feels like a bus ride. But the cost of this empire is high. The brain drain from the islands continues. The best and the brightest still look to New York as the ultimate proving ground. This leaves the islands in a state of constant recovery. The diaspora is a powerful shadow, but it is still a shadow cast by a distant sun. There is a lingering guilt among those who made it. They have the New York dream, but they miss the island peace. They have the central heating, but they miss the breeze. Today, the Caribbean influence on New York is total. It is in the way the city speaks. It is in the way the city eats. It is in the way the city moves. From the Dominican salons in Inwood to the Guyanese roti shops in Richmond Hill, the Caribbean has saved New York from being a generic global city. It has given it soul. It has given it grit. The migration continues, but it looks different now. It is digital. It is high speed. But at its core, it is still about the same thing. Reinvention. It is the belief that you can land in a place that doesn't know your name, and within two generations, you can own the street. Our history in this city is not a history of being welcomed. It is a history of being unstoppable. The legacy is not in the buildings. It is in the people. It is in the child, in a Brooklyn classroom, who knows exactly where their grandmother's village is, even if they have never seen it. It is in the flags that fly from the car windows every September. The city tried to break the migrant. Instead, the migrant broke the city and rebuilt it in their own image. The work is not finished. The rent is due. The cold is still there. But we are no longer afraid of the wind.